Support for WPR comes from Stone Harbor, a Door County resort and conference center overlooking the historic Steel Bridge in Sturgeon Bay. Details about hosting a wedding or conference are at stoneharbor-resort.com.
Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
While some of you may be experts in one kind of plant like roses or daylilies, most of us have a little bit of everything in our gardens, plus a lawn as well. Well, we're lucky to have such a great group of UW Extension horticulture educators in our state. They answer any and every type of question you can imagine, and they do it with a smile. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today we have Patty Nagai here to help. Patty is a UW Extension horticulture educator working in Racine County and always has lots of great information to share. Patty, as always, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I love being on this show. We always get such great questions.
We do. And often the listeners help each other out, which is always wonderful, too.
And they help me out, too.
There you go. Well, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org, or you can post a question, comment, or garden photo on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. Well, Patty, here we are in August already. A lot of veggies are in full swing right now, but we can also be thinking a little further down the line. What could we plant now or soon for another fall harvest?
That's such a great question. And so many people this time of year, they look at their failures over the summer in their garden, and they look at decline. Perhaps their squash are all infested with powdery mildew,
or squash
borers
got a
hold of them. Their lettuce plants that they didn't harvest are now flowering, which I have to admit, I leave those in my garden because I just think they're beautiful. So I have lettuce flowering in my garden
right now,
along with some bok choy, which is
also
quite lovely.
If we can have ornamental kale, why can't we have ornamental lettuce, right?
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. But I think that people this time of year think, oh my gosh, into the summer, it's time to start thinking about shutting it all down and cleaning it up. But it's really a time for planting a lot of things. And so in our vegetable garden, there are still so many different vegetables that you can plant now and still be able to harvest in the fall.
That's great.
And so if you're trying to maximize your space, you might be growing in a container or a small raised bed. There are so many different things that you can plant now, even if you live in the northern areas, and still get some produce back. So the important thing is to be very familiar with the types of vegetables that you're trying to grow. Know how long it takes for them to reach that maturity. So, and you can find that on the back of a seed packet or on a plant label or in a catalog
or
on the website or from me. And then, making sure that you count carefully to make sure that you at least have a chance to get it harvested before the frost, but also to select those plants that are very cold hardy. So the entire brassica family, that Brassicaceae family that contains cabbage and kale and collards and radish and turnip, all of those things are very frost tolerant. Some of them are freeze tolerant.
And in fact, some of them taste better after there's been a frost.
A lot of the vegetables will taste better when they're harvested in the fall after the temperatures have really dropped. And there's a great reason for that, and that's these plants that are cold tolerant have a mechanism to cryoprotect, to protect their cells from freezing, and that mechanism is to increase their sugar content. And so the flavors are often enhanced, but also the sugar content will be somewhat enhanced. And so carrots harvested in fall will taste very sweet. Brussels sprouts are always better when they're harvested late in the season after the temperatures have dropped, as well as everything in that entire brassica family. But it's not too late to plant things like leaf lettuce, too. Leaf lettuce develops pretty quickly, and you can get a nice crop out of it. If you like the Asian greens, if you want to plant bok choy or pak choy, whatever you want to call it, same thing. Those plants can be grown from seed and you'll still be able to harvest them this fall. So there are lots of things that you can still put in your vegetable garden. If you're not into vegetables and you want to plant ornamentals, this is a great time to go perennial shopping. The perennials will typically be marked down at all of your local garden centers and nurseries. So shop local and buy what they have on sale and find a place for it in your yard, because fall is a great time to plant. The soil temperatures are still warm. The air temperatures are getting cooler, so you don't have as much wilting mm-hmm. and transpiration loss because of that. And, you know, we typically get pretty decent rainfall in the fall. So, you know, whatever you plant, make sure you keep it watered. But yes, it's, you know, fall is a great time to garden.
But I think you're right. Mentally, we're starting to think, oh, well, you know, this worked well, this didn't. You know, we're getting towards the end. But going back to things that we can plant now, what about things like beans? Is that something that there's enough time for?
It depends on where you live. Okay. And it depends a little bit on Mother Nature and what she has in store for us this fall. There are bush bean cultivars that will mature in 40 to 42 days. And so if you look specifically for one of the short season bush beans, not pole beans, mm-hmm. you don't have time for pole beans, it is theoretically possible that you could get beans. August, you know, August is by the time you reach mid-August, it's too late, even in the southeastern okay. portion of the state, to plant bush beans. But in some portions of the state, you could still get a nice little crop of bush beans. And the reason for that is that those beans are bred for they're bred for mechanical harvest. So they mm. bloom prolifically all at once. And so you will get a huge number of beans all at once.
Oh,
so
okay.
when it says 40 to 42 days for bean production, you really could have a huge number of beans in 42 days. For some things, that days to harvest means the time for the first production. And so
okay.
if you're looking at pole beans, you know.
So you might get two beans in 45
exactly.
days. But,
a lot of it at this point, for things like beans that are warm season plants, it really depends on Mother Nature, because they do not like cold temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you count up 40 days, and that will put us into towards the end of September. If you're in a part of the state where you could potentially get frost by September 24th or earlier, beans are a little bit more risky because they are warm season. But all of those cool season plants, lettuce, turnips, you know, all of those things, radish, you can still plant those.
Great.
Absolutely.
There's hope.
There's always hope. And there's always next year.
There is. Well, and that's actually another thing I wanted to talk about. There are things that we can plant in the late summer or fall that are really for the next year.
Absolutely. And so garlic, of course, is the first thing that comes to mind for vegetable gardeners. You know, garlic is planted in mid to late fall, the same time you plant your tulips.
Okay.
So garlic would be planted, you know, ideally in the fall, because again, the soil is still warm. The roots have a chance mm-hmm. to develop, and you can get a really nice, healthy root system prior to the ground freezing and winter coming back. I hate to even say that word. I know people will cringe. Winter, oh no. And then garlic will be harvested in the summer. So it needs a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
To develop. And so that's,
I remember we talked at length about garlic another mm-hmm. time, and you said it's really kind of finding that sweet spot. We don't want to put it in too early. Like, this would be way too early.
Oh, this is too early. Yes.
Because all that delicate,
right.
that delicate right. greenery would be.
Yeah. No, about the same time that you would think about planting tulips
okay.
in wherever you are in your area, that would be when you would plant the garlic. So you want the soil to be still warm, but you really want the air temperatures to be cold, mm-hmm. reliably cold, and the day's really short, so that there's less chance of the plant actually growing top growth, but a good chance for the root system to develop.
We're talking with Patty Nagai. She's UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we had an email from Rachel in Middleton. She says, what can I do about slugs in my vegetable garden and straw bales? They are everywhere. I want to stay organic and safe.
Oh, slugs. Well, the good French answer would be to harvest them and eat them.
Because slugs are just snails with no shells.
That's right. And if you saute them in a little butter.
With garlic and parsley.
Absolutely.
What doesn't taste good with garlic
you
and parsley?
You have a French delicacy that's quite delicious. And especially if you're gardening organically, those slugs will be quite tasty and pesticide-free. So But if you want to not eat them and you want to kill them, there are some great organic products for taking care of slugs. You know, we used to recommend the beer bait dish of beer or the half drunk bottle of beer laid on its side so that the slugs can crawl in there, and that it works. It does. It's kind of gross because then you know you have a bowl full of soused and dead slugs. So you can try that, and it works. But there are also some products out there that are very organic and work beautifully on slugs, and they contain the compound iron phosphate. So I don't usually give brand names, but I don't know if there's another brand or not. But the one that you will prominently see is Sluggo, and it is organic. Hmm. It has the OMRI label right on there. And it's iron phosphate, so it works really well. They have another product that's a mixture of iron phosphate and spinosad, which is also organic. Mm. And the spinosad will take care of other insects that may be doing harm, like earwigs that feed at night. And so,
because sometimes it's hard to pinpoint exactly.
A combination.
You might
see a lot of slugs.
She's actually
seen the slugs, and you can usually tell if slugs are the damaging culprit on your plant because you will see their slime trails on the leaves, and they sparkle in the sunlight. So the slime trails, not the slugs.
Not the slugs themselves.
the slugs, much like the earwigs.
They might be more attractive if they sparkled in the sunlight.
Yeah. Well, perhaps then people would be more inclined to harvest and eat them if they were prettier. But that you can see the slug trails. So usually people know if they have slug damage. And slug damage is pretty defined. You know, you'll see large linear kinds of cuts out of the leaves, and they can do a tremendous amount of damage, not only on vegetable crops, but also on things like hostas. They love hostas. They love any place that they can have a great, moist, cool habitat where they can hide at night. So straw bales, perfect for slugs, perfect. But look for a product that contains iron phosphate and always follow the label instructions. You know, I always like to remind people that organic products are chemicals too, and it is imperative that you read and follow the label directions and always handle them safely. Just because they're organic does not mean that they are safe, and it doesn't mean that they're not chemicals. Mm-hmm. They are still chemicals. So follow the label directions, and whatever product you choose, make sure that it says vegetables on the label and slugs.
All right. Let's go to the phones, and Frank in La Crosse County is up first. Hi, Frank.
Good morning.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. I have about a 75-foot long row of daylilies, which grow wild here in La Crosse County, and I just transplanted them to the edge of my yard. And I've always got hundreds of blossoms every July for the last, more than 30 years. But this year, I only got 5 blossoms. Do you have any idea what's going on?
So are these the really tall, deep orangey-red kind of lilies? Okay.
Yeah. You know, I have heard this from other people as well. And so sometimes with cultivated lilies, you know, even the hybrids and those select cultivars that we might put into our gardens, if they get overcrowded, they may not send up flower blossoms, but I've heard more complaints this year than in previous years. So I'm not sure if it has something to do with the winter weather or the cold, or perhaps even if you're in an area where you've had a drought the last couple of years. There are so many different things that can affect flower blossom formation. And there are a number of, you know, different little insects and things. But the complaint that I've been generally hearing is that the plants look nice and vigorous and green and healthy. It's just the flower blossom number is down. But you have gotten some blossoms?
5. I counted 5, and usually I get hundreds. Now, I've never done anything to them. As I say, they grow wild here.
Right.
And they proliferate. They spread out like weeds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're just fine. But this year, for some reason, only 5 blossoms.
Yeah, and I can't say for sure what the problem is. Overcrowding can cause that, but there are also a number of different weather issues that can cause it as well. If you want to try and fertilize them, you could try that next spring. It's a little late to be doing that right now, but you could try some different types of fertilization. To increase that, you could try digging and dividing them. But if you want them to just naturalize like that, you can talk to Mother Nature and see if she treats them a little bit better next year. But I'm sorry, I don't really have a definitive answer for you. There are a lot of different possibilities. You know, you could just reach down in there and look around and see whether or not the flower buds are there and just haven't elongated yet. I mean, it's a possibility that they're just really late or stunted. But it's also possible that something early on killed the blossoms.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Good luck with that, Frank, and hopefully next year you'll have those hundreds of blossoms again.
It's disappointing when things don't behave like they're supposed to.
Well, and Roger in Lino Lakes, Minnesota, has a similar problem. He has a morning glory that is in full sun, growing tall and strong around his mailbox. He said it's a jungle vine, strong and deep green. He feeds it with Miracle-Gro, but it still doesn't blossom. What can he do for it or feed it to make it bloom?
He can stop fertilizing it. You know, morning glories are, and it depends on what kind of morning glory it is. The moonflowers, as an example of a type of ipomea, that vine takes forever to produce flower buds. It just takes a really long time. They prefer warm weather and long sunny days. And you know, our weather has been very interesting this spring and summer, so it's possible that the cultivar that you have is just very delayed. But if you over-fertilize any type of flowering plant with excessive nitrogen, you will get that very lush, green, vigorous growth, but it may impact the number of flower buds you have. So there are fertilizers that are specifically developed to enhance flowering, and they have a different ratio of nitrogen to phosphorus to potassium to try and enhance flowering. But if you've been fertilizing regularly, you probably don't need any more fertilizer.
Okay.
So you just need to back off on the fertilizer and give it a little bit more time and see if the flower buds come.
It's kind of counterintuitive, isn't it?
It is, yes.
You think, well, they must need more.
I know people who have grown tomatoes 20 feet tall and just been so proud because they've got these vines that are, you know, growing over the roof of their house. But they don't have any tomatoes on them because they've just gotten a little carried away with the nitrogen. And so these types of vining plants that have an indeterminate growth habit will continue to grow and push out vegetative growth if they're given those nutrients to allow them that.
So we want to not starve them, but keep them lean and mean.
Yeah, lean and mean. And, you know, the balance between those nutrient levels are really important. And so if you get the nitrogen out of whack, they just give you lots of green growth.
All right. We are talking with Patty Nagai. She is UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. It's Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Cheryl Gasser, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next week on Garden Talk, we'll have another great UW Extension horticulture educator with us. Sharon Morrissey works with gardeners in Milwaukee County. Right now, we're talking with Patty Nagai, her colleague in Racine County. And you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And let's go back to the phones and Lois in Eau Claire. Hi, Lois.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I have the infamous white powdery mildew on my squash plants.
And
I'm
sorry.
My question is, does that harm the vegetable, and can I eat it?
Oh, you can eat the vegetable. But what will happen if the powdery mildew is not controlled, it will continue to spread. And given the right environmental conditions, it will spread very rapidly. And you could essentially lose all the foliage on your plants. And at some point, it will start to affect the stems and the fruit as well. And so you can harvest the fruit that's on there now, and it's, you know, perfectly fine. But if you don't try to control it, you could end up losing the plants completely.
And so what is good control for powdery mildew?
We have a fact sheet on powdery mildew that you can access on our Wisconsin Horticulture website. But there are a number of products that you can use to control powdery mildew. The important thing to remember is that once the plant has powdery mildew, it has it. So the products aren't going to kill the disease. What they do is they protect new foliage from getting it. So a lot of people will go in and pull the seriously affected foliage off. They will remove all of that from the garden because it's going to be a constant source of spores to reinfect. Then they will apply either one of the synthetic fungicides that can help control powdery mildew, or, you know, we're right in the middle of harvesting for in a lot of areas for the squash, and so a lot of people don't want to use the synthetic products because I think most of them have a harvest wait time, you know, of several days.
But as we know with squash, it can go from 2 ounces to 2 pounds overnight practically.
So. Yeah, so you probably, you know, you might want to look at some of the organic options. There are many different organic options. So some of them contain copper or sulfur. There is a home remedy that it's described in the fact sheet that's a baking soda and oil mixture that you can mix up yourself. And we normally don't recommend home remedies, but this particular one has been tested extensively at a number of different universities. And it works fairly well if you apply it on a regular basis and mix it correctly.
Mm-hmm. And that's on the fact sheet. And this is a powdery mildew fact sheet.
Powdery mildew fact sheet. And it's available on the Horticulture website, which is hort.uwex.edu. And it'll tell you exactly how to mix it up. And just like anything else, it has to be done exactly.
Mm-hmm. And we'll ask Cheryl to put that up during the show so people can find that on the Facebook page. Yeah.
And so powdery mildew is one of those things that if the environment is right, squash is going to get it. You know?
What else is particularly susceptible?
Well, there are a lot of plants that are susceptible to powdery mildew, but powdery mildew is one of those groups of diseases. So we call lots of things powdery mildew, but they're actually different diseases. So the powdery mildew that gets on your squash is not the same one that's going to get on your lilac or on your lawn or anything else. So,
I seem to remember rosemary being very susceptible.
Oh, I don't know. That's an interesting question. I have never seen powdery mildew on my rosemary, but that doesn't mean that it can't get it. This would be a great question the next time Dr. Death,
there we go.
Brian Huddleston is on, because powdery mildew is one of his favorite diseases.
Oh, but he likes them all so much.
Yes, but powdery mildew, he has a very particular fondness for.
That's why we love Brian. He loves those things that the rest of us want to keep at arm's distance.
That's right.
Well, so Lois, it looks like there's some good solutions for that, and you can definitely harvest your squash. And actually, Samantha on Facebook had a question also about squash, how to get rid of squash vine borers.
Oh, those nasty little bugs. Squash vine borers, you know, they fly pretty early in the summer and you can see them. I mean, they're very distinctive. It's actually a clear wing moth and they're kind of long and they have kind of a reddish orange color and their wings are brown, but they're kind of transparent. And you start seeing those guys hovering around your squash leaves and you know you got to do something about it right away. So there are various types of insecticides that you can apply to the base of the plant. If you don't want to use insecticides, you can cover your entire squash plant with floating row cover until it's time for the bees to come and pollinate.
Because you have to watch
for the female flowers, not male flowers. You don't care about the male flowers. But when it starts making female flowers, then you have to uncover them. But generally by then, the squash vine borer is gone. So exclusion actually works fairly well with this particular insect. I have played around with covering the base of the plants with aluminum foil, very creatively torn and twisted to kind of encase the bottom part of the plant. Seem to work fairly well. So
they're flying insects, but they come up through the bottom? Is that
yes, they fly. And you will see them hovering around the tops of your plants. But they lay their eggs. So they're hovering around, they mate, and then they lay their eggs towards the soil line. So pretty close to the bottom of the plant, they will lay their eggs. Those eggs will hatch, and the larvae will burrow into the base of the stem.
Oh, so it's not those adults. It's
no,
the larvae.
No. Okay. It's the larvae that develop from the eggs. So you try to exclude the adult so that they can't lay eggs, and that works pretty well. And even the insecticide treatment on the base of the plants I mean, it keeps them from laying the eggs.
Right. So you basically want to tell the adults, no vacancy,
no,
keep moving.
No, stay away from my plants. But you have to kind of watch for them and know when they come. Once they're in the plant, usually only one larvae survives and does the damage. Apparently, they're carnivorous. They're cannibalistic. They eat each other.
Okay.
So they like to just have room for just one. And so this nasty larvae, it gets kind of big. And that's how it kills
the plant.
Well,
sure, it ate all its siblings.
Yes, because it ate all its siblings. I think there's a little song about worms eating other worms. But it will start to make a big wound in the plant. And so you can see that.
Mm-hmm.
If you so desire, you can slit that vine and take a little paper clip or a little tiny little tool of some kind and scoop that larvae right out. Many times the vine will heal over.
Hmm.
But if you don't get the larvae out, it'll kill the vine.
So it sounds like vigilance is a big
plus
here.
Yeah, you have to watch for it and then take action either right away before the eggs are laid. But if you miss that and you have a vine dying, you sometimes can get that insect, that larvae, right out of there, and the vine will heal over and it'll recover, which is pretty amazing when you think about it.
We will go back to the phones in just a moment, but we have another squash question, so let's take care of that. Helen in Green Bay sent an email that she has a volunteer squash of some sort growing in her compost pile. She wonders if she should let it go, or will it take all the nutrients out of the compost? And if she does let it grow, does it need anything more than water and sun? It's got a great growing medium.
I'm thinking that the compost pile is a great place for a squash vine to grow. I sometimes have this happen also, and it's probably pumpkin because when we're carving pumpkins in the fall, I will put those seeds in my compost pile, even though
I know. You don't roast them?
Well, only a few because my children like the idea of it.
More
and
than
they
the actual
won't,
seeds.
They won't eat them.
You can always give them to me, Patty. I promise.
Well, you know what? This fall, you are getting a big pile of roasted
I will hold you to
seeds.
That.
But a lot of times they will come up. I mean, I sometimes have tomatoes coming up in my compost pile, too, and avocados
and
all
sorts
of things.
So it should be a viable plant or no?
It'll be a viable plant. Depending on what it was that it started with, there is a chance it could be a cross-pollinated seed of unknown genetics producing some very interesting thing. But it just depends on what it was that she put in.
But there's no reason not to leave it. It's not going to
No,
drain
it'll be fine. Even, you know, the chances of it actually producing fruit are pretty minor. I mean, it could.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to let it grow and see what it really is and what it produces, that's fine. Eventually, it's probably going to end up back in the compost pile
All right. Let's go back to the phones. And Tom in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
I have a question about your garlic that you mentioned a little bit ago.
Sure.
In the spring, I planted garlic and it came up rather nicely. I have had a few scapes that I've cut back about 10 inches. However, at this time of the year, they just haven't died back. So the question becomes is whether I should dig them up, dry them out, and then replant them, or should I just fertilize and just leave them go, or cut off the tops at some point on my own, or just let them die off and then dig them up next year. Help me out.
Okay, I'll try to help you. I've had this question before because, interestingly enough, most of the garden centers, at least around my area, sell garlic in the spring instead of in the fall. And so people will plant it in the spring. You can do that, and you will get a fairly decent bulb. I would not recommend just letting it go. I think you need to go out there and actually pull one of them up and see what it looks like. If it has already formed a bulb, you should harvest those now and go through the curing process. So that's, you know, high heat, high humidity, good aeration, so that, and see if you can get the skin to develop on the garlic bulb so that they could be stored. And then you have a choice. You can either store it to use for eating, or you could separate out those those cloves and plant them later on this fall when the temperatures drop and it's a better time to plant. So, but I wouldn't just leave them in the garden and let them go through another year. You might want to try one or two mm-hmm. just to see what happens, but that would not be my first inclination. But someone else who is a more of a professional garlic grower may have some different advice for you, so keep listening.
Okay, one more question about the garlic.
Sure.
I did plant two different kinds. One was a purple garlic and the other was California garlic.
Mm-hmm.
The California garlic surprisingly came up. The purple
sure.
garlic, just not one of them came up.
Hmm.
Do you have any reason to know why a whole bag full of purple garlic wouldn't come up?
Was it shriveled?
No.
No.
No. It came from a commercial vendor,
hmm.
and in the mail, and it looked like every other piece of garlic that I had.
Wow.
Just didn't come.
Huh.
You have any idea?
I don't know. You know, we've grown a lot of different types in our teaching garden, and we haven't had a problem with that. So I would go back to the seller and ask him, you know, was this a problem with other people or was it just me? I mean, it is possible that something in your soil ate it. They just like the purple one better than the California, probably completely different types of garlic. You know, the California garlic tends to be soft neck types, and the purple, was it a hard neck purple?
Yeah.
And so, you know, there it's possible that whatever was in your soil really liked the purple one better mm. and just ate it all, or it might have succumbed to some rot organism. But the other possibility is that something happened to it at the growers that caused it to not grow. So I would definitely send them an email and ask them if other people had noticed this, that particular cultivar didn't grow for them. Best case scenario is they say, yes, I'm glad you told us about this. We'd be happy to send you some brand new garlic to grow in your garden
mm-hmm.
without charging you for it.
But so. It sounds like digging it up and seeing
yeah, for the
if
one that's,
something is
that's there.
There.
Yeah, dig it up and see what it looks like.
But even the one that didn't come up, digging up to see
well,
if it's rotted.
There's
or...
probably nothing left by this time. But
you never know.
You never know.
Good luck with that, Tom. And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. I wanted to let people know Barbara on Facebook posted this, but I also saw it on Melinda Meyer's Twitter account today. It's National Sneak Some Zucchini Into Your Neighbor's Porch Day. So for all those people that have way too much zucchini, This is the officially sanctioned day to get rid of it.
That's funny. I would, however, recommend that you take all of your zucchini and you take it to your local food pantry.
Excellent idea. Yes.
And, you know, with zucchini as well as all those other squash and many other types of vegetables, the more you harvest, the more they will produce.
Mm-hmm.
But if you let them grow to the point of seed maturation on your plants, then they stop producing completely.
And actually, coming up on Monday, Larry is back, and at 11, he's going to talk with the author of a great new book, Smitten with Squash. And it's all
Ooh.
About zucchinis, and so summer squashes, but also winter squashes, how to grow them, how to cook with them. We'll have great recipes. So
many wonderful squash out there.
Let's go back to the phones, and Aggie in Manitowoc is next. Hi, Aggie.
Hi. I've got some hydrangea plants bushes that I just started last year, bought them, and they're next in by my peonies and my other plants, and the hydrangeas got some brown spots on the leaves, and then they eventually got like the whole leaf turned brown and they fell off. What is that?
I don't know. I'm sorry. That's just sad. I mean, there are a number of different leaf spot diseases that can affect hydrangeas, but to know for certain, you would really need to take some fresh samples and get them to the plant disease diagnostic clinic and have them analyzed to see what it is. It could be, you know, transplant shock. I mean, sometimes, you know, when we put plants into the ground and they takes them a while to adapt to their new location. And if they're subjected to, you know, drought or overwatering or some environmental condition that they're not used to, you know, you can get browning and leaf drop from that. But there are some leaf diseases that can affect hydrangea, and it's possible that, that yours have been subjected to something along those lines. But I can't tell you for certain what it is, so you need to send a sample in.
And that's to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab.
What county are you in?
She's in Manitowoc.
Manitowoc.
You know, you could bring a sample into your local county extension office and have them look at it. And they could help you with the diagnosis. But ultimately, the sample needs to be sent into the disease diagnostic clinic for to have a cultured look at it.
And has it spread to the peonies or not?
No.
Okay.
No, that would be very weird if it had, because they're not related.
Very not related. Okay.
You know, those leaf spot diseases in many cases are very species specific.
All right. Well, good luck with that, Aggie. And, you know, we have some other calls, but I want to make sure that we talk about cover crops, because that's something you really wanted to bring up. What purpose do cover crops serve?
Oh, cover crops are fabulous. And we actually had an email from a master gardener even before.
He
was just
prescient.
So excited. He said, you got to talk about cover crops. And he sent some beautiful photos of cover crops in action.
And actually, that listener, it was listener Don in Fish Creek, and we put the link up on the Facebook page to that USDA site about cover crops for Wisconsin that he referred to. So that's up as a comment on the Facebook page.
Right, and that's a great resource. But I wanted people to know that we also have a new publication available for home gardens. And so it's Cover Crops for the Home Garden. And you can get that from the Learning Store site, which is a really nice publication. And it is scaled down to smaller gardens,
great,
you know, even for raised beds and things like that. So cover crops are a fabulous way to renew your soil, to reduce your seed population. Cover crops, you know, they can count as a crop rotation. So they help to replenish the soil with nutrients. They can do all sorts of great things. So if you've, you know, and that's the other thing that you can do this fall. If you've had a particularly frustrating year in part of your garden, maybe your squash has all succumbed to powdery mildew, and or maybe you've got an area where the weeds have gotten the best of you. You know, you can just clean that area up, plant one of the cover crop species. They will grow beautifully and look pretty, and you know, they give you that sense of satisfaction.
So do you plant them now, or when
some of them you can plant now, and you can some of them you can till under or turn under this fall. Some of them you can just mow down, and then you know, you can turn them under next year. Some of them are winter killed, some of them will overwinter. So there are a lot of different plants that you can choose from to use for a cover crop depending on your particular situation, where you are in the state, what you're growing, your hardiness zone is, and what you hope to accomplish. An easy one that a lot of people use will be one of the cereal rye. And there are winter hardy cereal rye that you can plant in the fall and then turn them under in the spring. Buckwheat is a really popular one. Buckwheat can be a weed problem if you let it flower and set seed. But as long as you cut it before it's set seed.
And buckwheat is actually a grass.
Buckwheat is not a grass.
Oh, it's not a grass. Mm-mm. I thought it was a grass.
No, and it's a very, it sounds like it should be, but it's not. But it has a different sort of look to it. But you can, that one's great because it has some allelopathy components to it. So it helps to reduce weed populations through its root system. You can plant radish or turnips or a lot of the brassicas can be used. The oilseed brassicas can be used as cover crops, and they help to really increase the nutrition level of the soil. So,
and what do we mean by oilseed brassicas?
So that would be like the canola.
Oh, okay.
But even the radish, you know, all of them make an oilseed to a certain. But there actually is a cover crop called oilseed radish.
Oh, okay.
And so that's the name of it.
Well, and again, we have that the link to the USDA
site
and up. Then, and then there's
the publication on the Learning Store is fabulous. A really popular one for Southeast Wisconsin is a pea and oat mixture. So it's peas and oats, and you can sow it now, and then it won't survive the winter. But You can turn it in the fall or you can turn it in the spring. And all of these things help to reduce the weed population, but they also, once you turn that organic matter into the soil, it really helps to replenish the soil. Some of them will help to penetrate soil, compacted soils, and they help in that way. So,
and do the peas also fix nitrogen?
They do, and that's why they use that pea-oat mixture, because oat, you know, is a grass, and they're both cool season, and so they do fairly well in the cooler weather. But eventually they will be killed off.
We are talking with Patty Nagai. She is UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller and enjoying a conversation with Patty Nagai. She is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County and has lots of great information. And speaking of great information, Cheryl Gasser, our on-air producer, put the powdery mildew fact sheet up on the Facebook page. So,
excellent.
And again, for people who maybe aren't on Facebook but can get to it online, it's at hort.uwex.edu and then search powdery mildew. Well, let's go back to the phones, and Gary in Ween is up next. Hi, Gary.
Good morning.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about getting rid of comfrey. I had it in one location in a flower garden, and it was starting to get a little out of control, so I dug some up and put it on a compost pile on the edge of another flower garden. And unfortunately, it took off there and spread into where I had a patch of pampas grass. And so I went in and cleaned out the pampas grass and dug out the comfrey last summer. I dug out all the comfrey. Then I covered the whole area with a layer of cardboard and about 4 inches of leaves. And now this year, the comfrey has come up through the cardboard, through the leaves, and yesterday I was out and I think I dug like, you know, 15 comfrey plants that had come up.
Wow. You are a very good gardener at growing that.
I don't think so, otherwise I wouldn't have that comfrey problem.
I've never grown comfrey. It has, you know, I know it's a medicinal, so it has lots of interesting uses. Is it spreading through the root system, or is it spreading from seed, or both?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
You know, my gardening knowledge is fairly limited.
Yeah.
And it just...
You are, I'm assuming you're letting it flower, though.
Well, not last year in that area. This garden where I put it, you know, had that mulch pile and where it grew up, it flowered in past years, but last year I had it all dug off and cleaned off, and even those that some came up after I dug up, you know, leaves came back up, and I even touched it with a little bit of Roundup.
And it still survived.
And it still survived. It is like amazing stuff.
Well, I know it's a very vigorous plant, so I'm assuming it does have a very vigorous root system as well, especially, you know, it's a perennial, so it's going to come back. And if its root system is spreading that way, aside from being very diligent about digging up all of the roots, the use of a product like glyphosate may be the only way to really stop its spread. However, if it has flowered and set seed, even if you kill the existing plants, you know, those seeds are still going to be in the garden. So then you're going to have to be really diligent to look for any seedlings that are coming up. So I'm assuming that you know what the seedlings look like so that you can eradicate them before they get to the size that they're spreading their roots again.
And certainly don't let them go to flower and seed.
Yeah. And you know, gardeners, you shouldn't say that you're not a good gardener, because I think all gardeners do this at some point with some plant. And then they realize, you know, that, oh, hindsight is always so perfect. I should not have planted that there. Or maybe I should not have planted that at all. And a lot of the herbs are like that because they're just so incredibly vigorous. You know, the
oregano.
Oregano is the one that I was going to say. Oregano. Oh, my gosh. I have oregano coming up everywhere. But even perilla, I don't know if people grow perilla or not, but it's in Japanese, it's called shiso, and it's kind of like basil, a little bit different. But it's in that same family with all of those plants that are so vigorous. And it just, it really takes diligence. Once you have made an error with a plant that is very prolific, you have to be really diligent about getting it out of your garden. And unfortunately, if you're not really in love with lots of it, you probably need to get rid of all of it. And so it becomes looking for the seedlings and making sure that you're getting those out. And any existing plants, making sure they don't flower, doing the cut and glyphosate application in the fall when it's most effective, because then in the fall, the glyphosate will be translocated down into the roots and hopefully kill all the roots. So, yeah, good luck.
All right, good luck with that, Gary. Let's go now to Darwin in Milwaukee. Hi, Darwin.
Hi, how are you? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Excellent. Wonderful. Love your show.
Thanks.
I am having a summer of chasing pests down in the garden. I went running a couple weeks ago for BT when I found cabbage worms. And now my problem is the cucumber beetle, the dreaded cucumber beetle.
The striped one or the spotted one?
The striped one.
Striped one, yes. They are quite high in numbers this year in Racine. I mean, we've seen a lot of cucumber beetle. And they're nasty because they carry bacterial wilt. Mm. So if you're growing cucumbers, cucumbers are very susceptible to bacterial wilt, but some of the other cucurbits are susceptible to it as well. So controlling the cucumber beetle becomes pretty important. I've actually seen them in high enough numbers where they feed directly on the fruit of the plants. So even pumpkins, fruit, they feed directly on the pumpkin, which is weird because pumpkin is not really their favorite food, but they just get in such high numbers very quickly. The pressure is pretty extreme.
So once you see them, is there anything you can do effectively to get rid of them?
Well, you know, there's some interesting methods for using trap plants that you plant on the sides of your garden, and then when the cucumber beetles go to those trap plants, then you very quickly harvest those up and put them in a bag and do what you will with them. So there are some methods for that kind of control. There are insecticides that you can use to control cucumber beetle, both organic and synthetic. So it's just a matter of choosing the product that best meets your need. It definitely has to have vegetables and or cucumber on the label and cucumber beetle. And all recommendations have to be followed, you know, to the letter. With any insecticide, you'd want to be very careful not to apply it at a time when the bees are flying, because even organic insecticides can harm bees. So make sure that you are not applying them when the bees are out flying. And as crazy as this sounds, try not to spray it directly on the flowers, because, you know, even if you spray it in the evening when the bees aren't flying, if you get it on the flowers, the bees visit the next morning and you could inadvertently kill your pollinators.
So there are some products that
there are many products out there that can be used for cucumber beetle. The trap plants are an interesting thing, and I don't remember off the top of my head which plants are so attractive to cucumber beetle aside from cucumber. Mm-hmm. But there are some plants that you can use for trapping. Early in the season, you can cover your plants with floating row cover, but you have to have them really tightly covered. And again, you have to take floating row cover off as soon as the female flowers start to come, or you won't get any fruit. So there are some options with controlling them, but it's one of those things that you have to watch for them carefully and then make your choice about how you're going to control them.
All right. Good luck with that, Darwin. And, similarly, Mary on Facebook said that she has Japanese beetles on her raspberry bushes. What would you recommend she do for that?
I'm sorry. I would recommend hiring young children with buckets of soapy water to walk through your raspberries and knock the Japanese beetles off into the bucket of soapy water. once the raspberries are producing, there's really, I don't think there are any good products to use to control for Japanese beetle when you're actually in fruit production. And maybe, you know, maybe not even when they're not in fruit production. Japanese beetles can be killed by a number of different insecticides. That's not the issue. Mm-hmm. The issue is whether or not you want to apply any kind of chemical to your plants while they're producing fruit or when they're going to be producing fruit. So I like the idea of manual control on Japanese beetles. Other people may have some other ideas about how best to do that. But knocking them off into a bucket of soapy water actually works pretty well. And there's a lot of satisfaction in doing that.
Also, entomologist Phil Pelletieri has often said that Japanese beetles really seem to be cyclical. So you might have 3 or 4 years, which can seem like a long time when you're in it, where they're very bad. But right. then they tend to move on.
They move on. So they're attracted to a lot of different species of plants, not just raspberries. They go after 300 or 400 different species of plants. They're just very, you know, voracious and not very picky in that way. But they do like raspberries and grapes and apples and all that stuff. They like that a lot.
Are they the ones that make the hollyhock leaves look like complete lace, or
they'll,
is that something
they
else?
Will eat hollyhock, but yeah. Laciness, yes, laciness is one of the signs of that the Japanese beetles have been feeding, because they eat the tissue in between the veins of the leaves, and they're very good at skeletonizing leaves.
We had a Facebook comment from Rich going back to your ideas of planting lates. He says, seconds on the advice being given at this latitude, Rhinelander, Wisconsin, fall container gardening for leafy vegetables is very successful. He says, also factor in that our native soil, quote unquote, is mostly sand and gravel, and so containers permit them to precisely design the soils. But he said that they really do have a lot of success with those late plantings.
Yes, and you know, I do that in my containers as well. It's a beautiful thing, and you can put them right up by your back door.
And they're convenient. And then, actually, if it gets really cold, you can bring those containers inside overnight if you really need to.
You could if you really want a big pot of spinach in your
That doesn't sound too bad. Patty Nagai is a UW Extension horticulture educator. She works with gardeners in Racine County. We always appreciate when Patty spends time with us here on Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. And as I mentioned, next week we will have another great Extension Garden Talk guest. That will be Sharon Morrissey. She works with gardeners in Milwaukee County. Growing plants really helps to connect us with nature. And after all the hard work you've put into your garden this year, it makes sense to do whatever you can to keep it healthy and productive as long as possible. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. So good to have you with us for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Patty Nagai is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County, and she always has lots of great information to share. Patty, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's always my pleasure to talk to all the listeners. It's fun.
We have wonderful listeners.
You do. It's amazing.
Well, one of our wonderful listeners is Dan in Mosinee. So let's go to the phones. Hi, Dan. Dan, are you there?
Oh, did we lose Dan?
No, maybe we lost Dan. Well, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org or post a question or comment on our Facebook page. Dave and Adam's Friendship asked if, Patty, you have any advice on getting rid of bindweed, otherwise known as morning glories?
Well, bindweed is in the morning glory family, which is the same family as sweet potato. It's in that Convolvulaceae family, but it's a different species. And there are several different species of bindweed, but I think we typically just get one. And it's I am sorry you have it.
So honestly, it's very invasive.
It is very invasive. It's very difficult to get rid of. And it's another one of those plants that really requires diligence. It is so aggressive and invasive that you can get it in a lawn. And you will see, and it adapts to the mowing. So at a certain time in the summer, all of a sudden you have these little white blossoms all over your lawn. And you're like, why is my grass flowering?
You know? But it's the
vine. It's that bindweed growing through your grass. And so If you've got it in a grassy area, you can use a broadleaf weed control product to kill it. If you have it in your flower beds, you can hand pull. But if it's ever flowered and set seed, you will still have little ones coming up. And if you leave any of the root system in the ground, it will resprout. And so if you are an observant gardener and you see it when it first appears, it is possible to hand pull it and take care of it that way. If you have acquired a garden or have been away for a while and now you have bindweed everywhere and it's flowering, it will take you a long time to get rid of it. It's especially difficult when it gets in shrub beds because it will grow all through the shrubs and come up to the top and get entwined in all of the branches, and it's just very difficult. So it's one of those that if you can identify where the base of the plant is, cut it, apply some glyphosate, but it's a skinny little vine, and so it's not like trying to kill a woody plant with glyphosate. And again, if it's ever flowered, it'll be perpetual. It is, not that I have a favorite weed, but it is one of my least favorite weeds to deal with. And I have seen people completely rip out perennial and shrub beds and start over because of it.
Wow.
It can be that aggressive.
Well, Dave also asked if you know anything about the bindweed mite.
No, I don't. Is that a good thing?
Yeah. If it attacks the bindweed?
I don't know.
Well, maybe that's something that we can ask Phil Pelletieri, maybe.
Yes.
About a mite.
A bindweed right. mite. I want some. I know I want it.
Really, really. And Lynette in Richfield has a large garden plot that she never got around to planting this year. She's wondering what she should do now to get it ready for next spring. Should she just rototill it or maybe plant a cover crop?
Oh, this would be the perfect opportunity to put in a cover crop. Now, with cover crops, you just sow the entire area. So you could use peas and oats. You could use a cereal rye or any number of things can be used as a cover crop. And that will help make your garden better for next year. But if you're thinking that you actually want to plant something edible, consider one of the leafy greens or brassicas. If the soil is really good and rich and well-drained, you might even try one of the shorter season carrots, like one of the Nantes or Chantenay types that have a tiny little storage root. Because carrots, if you can get them started now and you're in an area that you have at least 2 months to grow, some of those shorter season carrots, you would be able to harvest them, like at Thanksgiving. Mm,
perfect.
And they would be super sweet. But the leaf lettuces, the bok choy, radish, turnips, collard greens, kale, all of those things can still be planted right now. So you have a choice.
Great.
Cover crops or plant it to harvest, but do something with
right.
it.
Might yeah. as well take advantage of it.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones, and Dawn in Broadhead is up. Hi, Dawn.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a row of rhubarb that I planted this spring too close to my asparagus, and now that my asparagus is as big as trees, it's shading it, and it's not doing well. Can I move that this fall? Or do I have to wait until spring to move it?
No, you can move it this fall. There are some special considerations when you're moving plants in the fall, but a lot of the perennials, fall is actually a great time to do it for a lot of the reasons that we discussed earlier, where, fall is really a good time to garden because the soil is still warm. And so plants that are put into the ground in the fall have a great opportunity to develop a really nice root system, especially if you keep it watered. And then they will be more productive for you next spring. So with rhubarb, make sure that you select a site that is very well drained. The downfall, rhubarb is very easy to grow as long as you site it correctly. So you need a sunny location and a very well drained soil. So make sure that you've got the site ready for it and, go ahead and dig. You don't want it to be too deep of a hole because you don't know exactly how big your root ball is going to be when you dig it out. Cut the outer leaves off, the bigger leaves, so that you have a smaller leaf area that it will, continue to transpire and lose water. That will help with some of the wilting issues. Wait for a cool day or do it in the evening when it's a little bit cooler. move it over to the new location, make sure that you water it really well, and kind of keep an eye on it for the, you know, until the ground freezes to make sure that it doesn't get too dry, but you still don't want it sitting in water. So as long as you put it in a nice location that's well drained, you'll be fine.
All right.
About in October, do you think?
I would do it in September. I would do it earlier than that. You know, in September, okay, our days are getting really short, and it's we're starting to get those nice cool nights, and that gives it a little bit more time to establish a root system. So it's a little bit different than planting bulbs because you don't want any leaf growth with bulbs, and so we wait until October generally to plant those bulb plants. But if you're going to be moving perennials around, including things like rhubarb, September is a great time to do it.
Good luck with that, Dawn. And you're going to laugh, Patty. We've had several people post on the Facebook page about the comfrey invasion, as one person referred to it. So Bonnie says, for the fellow with the comfrey problem, organic meat farmers and permaculture gardeners love comfrey. If he were to offer it up on Craigslist or a similar kind of site, folks would be happy to come and dig it up for him. Bonnie says, I can't get enough of it.
Oh, my gosh.
And then Barbara, funny, along the same line, said, oh, that lucky guy with the comfrey. I actually bought roots for three varieties this spring. I've read it can be used as a liquid fertilizer like compost tea, and also it is nutrient rich. Cut it back and use it as mulch a few times each season. Sell the root online. I'm jealous. Then we have Josh, who is a little more along the lines of our caller who is having the comfrey problem. In response to the gentleman with the comfrey invasion, I have the problem too, and have with some investigation learned that you need to actually paint full strength Roundup on the fuzzy leaves. I was able to get rid of most of mine this way. So who knew comfrey was such a polarizing
plant? Love it or hate it, it seems like. I've never grown it, and I was thinking, well, I don't want to grow it now that I know that it's so invasive, but if it has so many fabulous uses, so, I don't know.
So maybe Joy Cardine can do that as the big question sometime, comfrey or not comfrey. Well, let's go back to the phones and Dan in Mosinee. Hi, Dan.
How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Two quick questions. One, I had garlic that I had in a garden that kind of came with weeds last year, so I just left it in. This spring, I dug it and transplanted it, but the bulbs never got very much bigger than what they were before. I would say they're the size of maybe a quarter at the biggest, and I was wondering if it's just the variety of garlic, maybe?
There are so many different cultivars of garlic, and, you know, you've got all of these different groups of garlic. You've got soft neck and hard neck, which are like the major groups. And then underneath those, there's all these different types. And then under the types, there are all these different cultivars. And yes, they are different sizes. Some of them are huge. Some of them are small. Some of the size depends on what you start with and how well it's cultured and how long it has to grow. But some of it is cultivar dependent. So, you know, if you know what it was that you planted, and you're looking for something bigger, you can, you know, Google garlic cultivars in Wisconsin, and you'll come to this really great site that tells you all about all of the different types and varieties, and choose one that meets the characteristics that you're looking for. So it's important to choose one that we know will grow well in Wisconsin, but a lot of them will grow well. And then make sure that you're following the proper planting procedure for that particular cultivar. And most of them will do better if they're planted in the fall and then harvested like mid-July to late July.
And about this time last year, Patty, you were on and we talked at length about garlic. And we had a web story written up and posted then about a lot of the advice for planting garlic. I'll go ahead and repost that
after the show.
And one of the things that we talked about, I remember, is going to a farmer's market where you can talk to garlic producers, try the garlic, see if it's a variety
you like it. You
know, and then ask them for advice.
Right. So if you go online and look at all the different, and there's hundreds of different cultivars, they give you pretty good descriptions about the size and the flavor and the color. But there's nothing like tasting, really, to see if it's the one that you like.
And Dan, did you have another question?
Yeah, and then just on that one quick. So if I go to the website, would they also have places that you could purchase this through, do you think, or not?
Yes. Okay. And there are, I think, at least two local growers who have websites that you can buy directly from them.
Okay. Second question, the sweet corn is just starting to get ripe and the raccoons have found it. Any tips other than trapping them to keep them out? I don't want to fence it. It's too big.
Well, you can How big is it? Can you cover it with netting? Like
bird
netting?
It's starting to ripen already. The stalks are at least 5.5 feet high, and they're starting to pull them down.
Yeah, they will do that. And even if you cover them with bird netting, they won't. It can discourage them, but they are just electric fence is really an electric fence. It sounds horrible, but it actually works pretty well to keep them out. You just have to make sure that you have it at the right height. Hmm. We do have a publication on raccoons and managing them in your property. It would have been helpful if you had done that prior to the corn actually ripening, because honestly, if once it starts to ripen and they know it's there, you'll be lucky if you get any at all. You could try the bird netting. That's a very inexpensive method, but you do have to cover the whole plant in order to keep them out, and they may end up pulling the corn down, netting it all, but they won't be able to get the corn. So you might be able to salvage some of it. The only other thing I know of is the electric fence.
And Patty, that publication about managing raccoons in the garden, is that a learning store?
It's a learning store publication.
And that's the UW Extension Learning Store. Sorry to hear that, Dan.
Yeah, those raccoons, they're just evil sometimes.
Let's go back to the phones and Alina in Appleton. Hi, Alina.
Hi, it's Aaliyah, actually.
Oh, okay.
I'm calling because I recently purchased a home which was vacant for about 4 years, so nobody did anything to the ground. And there was large rocks, landscaping rocks. So I couldn't plant through those, and they had very thick paper underneath. So I had those removed. And then I went on vacation, and when I came back, my lovely husband had gone ahead and had the landscaper put down landscaping fabric and mulch over the top. Mm. So I have no idea what kind of soil is under there, and I'm wondering now, I've never dealt with landscaping fabric or mulch, and I've heard that you can just cut into it and plant your plant. However, when I do that, Can I just amend the soil right there where I'm putting the plant, or is it wise to kind of dig it up and take out all that work, and I'm not really sure what to do?
Well, I have many things to say about that. I am not fond of landscape fabric. I have dealt with it personally in a property that I purchased, and I have worked very diligently to get rid of it. Hmm. In the long run, it is very, very difficult to work with landscape fabric. And in the long run, it doesn't serve its purpose. So unfortunately, what happens, you mulch on top of it, and then the mulch decomposes and turns into this beautiful compost, mm-hmm. which is a great substrate for lots of weeds to grow. Mm. So the idea of landscape fabric is that it allows the water to go through, the rainwater to go through, and it's allegedly keeps the weeds from coming back up. So in the short run, it actually works for that, but in the long run, it doesn't. And it's very difficult to get rid of once it gets, once the mulch decomposes and other things start to grow around it, and eventually the roots of plants will grow through it, mm-hmm. both up and down, and so it... to me, it was like my personal nightmare trying to get rid of all that landscape fabric. So if it were me, even though your lovely husband had all the good intentions of the world, I would take it out. If you're not willing to do that, or if it's just a huge area and you don't want to do it, you can cut through the landscape fabric. You will need a pretty heavy duty sharp knife or a heavy duty pair of shears to cut through it. And you can cut holes, you can plant through it. It will be difficult to do any kind of soil amendment, though, if that's your intention. And without knowing what the soil is like under there, you may or may not need to amend the soil. Mm-hmm. And if you're planting shrubs, we don't generally recommend soil amendment for shrubs anyway. But if you're planting perennials and annuals, the landscape fabric will be a nightmare for you. As you move forward in your gardening process.
Aaliyah, how big of an area are you talking about?
It's not too big. It's just about 6 feet out of the house and probably
40 feet. I mean, I'm definitely going to pull it out because my idea is I like big, puffy English-type gardens, and from what I'm reading, having that landscape fabric down there won't allow
it. Won't work. No.
As
so landscape fabric.
To pull it out.
Okay, landscape fabric. You know, in large shrub beds. You know, that's where I see it used a lot, where it works okay. But again, it's still just a short-term fix for the weed problem, mm-hmm. because eventually you're going to get weeds anyway, and then you're going to have a mess of a time getting it out. So, yeah, sorry. Double
Be
work.
Sure to thank him first and then
yes.
pull it out.
Yes, make sure you thank him first because he had good intentions, and he probably had advice along that line that would help you. He was trying to help you.
I know. Just one more question,
sure.
if I could. Then after I pull that up, I can still just kind of push that mulch aside and plant down underneath it, and things should be okay.
Right. I mean, if you were really good, you could just take the landscape fabric and pull it off, mulch and all.
Kind of like the old tablecloth.
Yeah, like that. You don't want to incorporate the mulch into the ground, so you either need to rake the mulch off or, you know, pull the landscape fabric off and try and get the mulch out of there. So you don't want to incorporate your mulch. You can reuse the mulch once you figure out what your soil is like. If your soil is good and you don't need to amend it, you can, you know, just put that mulch right back on there.
Thanks for that call, Aaliyah. And Phil posted a couple photos up on the Facebook page. He says, a ground cover we have had great luck with this season is Epimedium Pink Champagne. He says it flowered for 82 days this year with up to 200 flowers per plant.
That everyone should go look at the Facebook
photo.
It's
really lovely. They look like little orchids almost.
They do look like orchids, like little dancing ladies.
Yeah, they're really lovely. Two-tone pink, really lovely. And speaking of looking like an orchid, Jennifer asks on the Facebook page, wondering if you could identify this type of orchid. And it looks like a Phalaenopsis to me.
It does look like a Phalaenopsis, and it's a white one.
Mm-hmm. And these are kind of the most common. We often call them like the grocery store orchids because they're widely
you can
available.
Buy them in the grocery store or any of the big box stores. You can get them at a pretty reasonable price. Mm-hmm. They bloom beautifully.
They hold their blossoms very easy
to grow. Yeah. And they typically will hold their blossoms for, you know, about 3 months. Mm-hmm. And if you take good care of them, they will bloom again the next year. They're pretty reliable and mm-hmm. easy to care for.
So that's Phalaenopsis, with a pH, right?
Phalaenopsis or a moth orchid. Mm-hmm. There are millions of cultivars of those, so don't ask me what cultivar it is.
Let's take a quick call from Pat in Elroy. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Judith and Patty. I have a question about raising lettuce late in the season.
Mm-hmm.
Last year I did an experiment with shade cloth, and during this time of the year in July last year was extremely hot, and so I started my seeds indoors, and I started several different kinds of lettuce. I had prize head and butter crunch and salad bowl and Lolo Rosa.
Mm-hmm.
And I started these all indoors where it was cool so that the seed would sprout because I was afraid the soil was just too hot that they wouldn't sprout outside. And when they got big enough, I transplanted them out, and I put the shade cloth over them right away. This was in a raised bed situation. And they grew very well. Some of them bolted very early despite the shade cloth.
Mm-hmm.
The others grew well, but they were bitter. And I couldn't even use them. And I wondered why.
What time of year did you do this?
Well, it was about now, maybe a little later. I think about August 15th was when I put some of them out.
Okay, we're running quite short on time, Pat, so let me give Patty a chance to respond.
Yeah, so lettuce will start to flower. They're short day plants, so they probably are just responding to the day length. The seeds will germinate even in warm soil. You have to have soil really super hot before the seeds won't germinate. But you need to look at the cultivars that you're growing and see whether or not they are suitable for fall production. I've had pretty good luck with some of the butter crunches and growing them in fall. But if they're bolting, it's more than likely a response to the day length or the night length, actually.
So it might be different this year, even with the same cultivars.
No, day length is about the same. So you need to to look and see if there's a day length, if there's one that's suitable for fall culture.
And we'll have to leave it there. Mm. So good luck with that, Pat. Patty, always great to have you with us. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Patty Nagai is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. Always great when she joins us for Garden Talk. Larry is back on Monday at 11. He'll talk with the author of Smitten with Squash. Thanks for listening.